What I was trying to move on to was Pacoon, which is easily the funniest novel I think I've ever read, which you wrote. It's about Ireland, set in Ireland, but you'd never been to Ireland when you wrote Pacoon.
No, I just used to listen to my father, who was Irish. Christ, he was Irish. He was so Irish, he'll give me an example of what he was like.
Yeah.
3 o'clock in the morning, he wakes me up, says, "Wake up!
Yeah.
Wake up!" So I said, "What is it, Dad?" He said, "I've never shot a tiger." So I said, "Why are you telling me?" And he said, "I've got to tell somebody."
Welcome to GoonPod, doing for comedy podcasts what the Edsel did for the US automobile industry. And I think that may be a bit too modern a reference for some of my listeners, Clive.
Oh, right. I think it's seemingly up to date.
Where are my manners? Yeah. My guest, my super special guest, comedy writer, broadcaster, chat show host, performer, warm-up man, podcaster now as well. Have I missed anything out? Anyway, it's Clive Anderson. Hello, Clive.
Hello. Hello, Tyler. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you. Did I miss anything there? Was there anything? A novelist? Have you written a novel? Or
I haven't written a novel. You know, obviously, there's a novel in everybody, apparently.
Yes.
But mine stays wedged within me. It hasn't come out yet. But you never know.
Well, for anyone who's not listened to this podcast before, it started off being a podcast very much anchored in the world of the Gooniverse, or the Goons, if you like. Milligan, Sellers, Seacombe, even Benteen. And it's gradually broadened out over the couple of years to talk about comedy in general, but always with a sort of a starting point being the Goons. Okay. Now, Clive, I know you enjoyed listening to the radio when you were a child, especially comedy. Was the Goon Show part of your upbringing?
I would say the Goon Show was a little bit early for me. I mean, I've certainly listened to it, you know, since, and in repeats and reruns and Radio 4 Extra and things like that. And I was certainly very well aware of the Goon Show early on. But it was kind of that my sort of era, I suppose, would have been like Monty Python on the television, or the radio by then was something like, I haven't a clue. Oh, sorry, I'll say that again. Sorry, which is the... I'll read that again, which was the...
That's it.
Big comedy show for my sort of generation.
Sure, yep.
So I came across the Goons themselves, Spike Milligan, Harry Seacombe and so forth, a bit later. Because by the time I was doing interviewing people on television, we had a lot of comedians on. I did eventually get to interview Spike Milligan, but he was quite senior by then. And towards the end of his life, but he was a good, challenging interviewee. Most interviews I can think back, I can remember, you know, a few salient points from it. The main thing I remember from interviewing him was he sort of told a joke, and it sort of occurred to him, and he sort of a laugh played on his lips, and he said, "Oh," I said it out loud, and it was as though he'd just thought of it. I can't even remember what the joke was, but I know that it was a joke I'd seen him do on previous chat shows.
Yes,
but he did it. He presented it as though it had just occurred to him, which was I put down to elegant, stylish professionalism, rather than just the fact that he was he hadn't really forgotten that he said it before. But I'd already cottoned on he was a sort of hero because he was so innovative in comedy. And I liked, he wrote, I think it's the only novel he wrote. You'll obviously know because you were this podcast built around the Goons. He wrote Pacoon, a novel where I think he concentrated quite a lot of his his sort of wartime memories. You know, he did those all those various bits of memoirs which had lots of good material. But in that novel, I think he concentrated it down really well. So I was a big fan of that novel. And every now and then, somebody tries to film it or to read it or something. It never quite works. It just works on the page as a written novel. So that's my small claim to have done anything to do with Spike Milligan.
Well, the interview that you, because I rewatched it for the purposes of this.
Was it? I mean, I don't know. I don't ask this question with vanity in mind. Was the interview any good? I don't. I mean, a lot of my interviews are quite easy to find now. What with the, YouTube, but I don't tend to watch them because they all they disappoint me one way or the other. They either think, oh, I remember that was a really good interview, and I watched it back and I think, oh, actually, it wasn't much very special, was it? Or I thought, oh, it was a disaster. It was so awful. It went horribly wrong. And I look at it again. It didn't look as much worse than, 100 other interviews. So they're a disappointment to me one way or another. So I haven't watched that, I don't think, back ever. So
Well,
you'll have to.
it was he was you were absolutely fine. You were trying to kind of, because the problem with Spike by that point, because it was 1995, and it was just in the wake of Groveling Little Bastard Gate as well,
Yes.
from the Comedy Awards the year before. In fact, it was only
Yeah.
a few months before.
Yes, I'd been at that award, so I'd seen him do it live, but as it were. I
Yes.
don't know why. Can you now tell me why? How was? Why was he on my show? Had other than was us asking him to be on? But
Well,
was he promoting something, or did he
no,
have something?
not really.
No.
Well, the thing was, I think he got his career got a little bit of, or his profile got a bit of a shot in the arm from those Comedy Awards because of the fallout from the Groveling Bastard
Yes.
line. Okay, and I've spoken to his daughter subsequently, and basically he'd been knocking back the wine. Because they were sort of encouraging the Comedy Awards, I believe the organizers sort of encouraged a lot of drinking, I believe.
Oh yeah, they were. It was this. The structure was quite built around that. So you all sat at a table. You had to be there early in order to get the, in and assembled for the cameras and so forth. And at your table, you might have a bowl of crisps and some nuts and an almost unlimited amount of drink. And you put a lot of comedians' egos clashing in the room. There was always a lot of shouting out and chai-iking. I think Jonathan Ross, I think, pretty well always presented them, and he was, comfortable in those circumstances. But it was a not always a noisy affair, and I think deliberately getting people to behave slightly too badly, I would say. But I'm probably a bit being a bit prissy about it. I think if there was slightly less people shouting out abuse at each other, it would probably been a more respected award ceremony.
Well, he hadn't apparently he hadn't really eaten that day, and he was quite nervous, and he's knocking back the red wine. So he got up on stage, and it just kind of it was just sort of spontaneous, apparently.
Here we go. I have a letter to read out to you from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales.
Do I kneel down for this?
I'm in enough trouble already. I'm not going to say a word.
And the Prince of Wales.
The Prince of Wales. I'm sorry I have to do this, but I know it takes a lot of the impact out of it, but here we go. As someone who grew up to the sounds of the Goon Show on the steam-driven wireless, I must confess that I've been a lifelong fan of the participants in the show, and particularly of Spike Milligan.
Oh, the little grovelling bastard.
But it did mean that he was, in all the newspapers subsequently and whatnot, and then turned up on Clive Anderson All Talk.
Oh, right.
Now, there's the clip of his interview on YouTube. Okay, I saw it when it went out, but that was 30 years ago, Clive. But so I watched that. Now, I believe that the actual show, the full show, that episode, your other guests were Norman Tebbit and Bjork.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I can only begin to imagine the conversation in the green room beforehand.
That's a good show. I liked having these combinations of guests because I don't know why we're so crazy with our guests. Bjork, I interviewed a couple of times, and I would say I did a bad interview first. I mean, she was great on both of them. The first one was largely me making jokes about Iceland and other related to it. But then she came back, and I loved her on both occasions, and she was very sweet, and we got more on to talking about her and her music and generally. So I think that in my mind anyway, there's a bad Bjork interview and a good Bjork. Norman Tebbit, he was quite hard person to lay a glove on, you know, in a even in the context of an interview with a studio audience who wouldn't have been particularly sympathetic towards him. He was quite a skilled operator in those circumstances because he was a bit funnier than people thought he was going to be. And so he rolled with the jibes and came. He wasn't aggressively back, but he was there for chuckling around. So now, yeah, all three together. That was an interesting...
Yeah,
I say that was a good combination. You know, not a good combination, but a good range of people to
absolutely.
Yeah,
Spike would have hated Tebbit, and he probably would have hated Bjork as well. he didn't really like many people by that point of his life.
No, he might not have followed music closely, but who knows? Yeah. They might have. I mean, there's even a possibility, and I don't want to shine too much light into the magic. Sometimes it wasn't quite. Sometimes we pre-recorded one interview, and so the people might not have all been in the same place together. But I think they probably would have been on that occasion. I can't remember a pre-record with any of those. But my memory is not that reliable on detail anymore. I think I used to be able to recall almost every moment of interviews, but now I can hardly. I'm doing well if I can remember they interviewed people at all.
Well, he was a little, because again, by the he was only 6-7 years before he died that you interviewed him, and he was quite frail, and by this period of his life he was often quite bitter.
I think he was a bit bitter because he'd been. Obviously, he was a brilliant writer, and he was always a bit under a strain, a bit liable to crack up under the effort, but full of innovative ideas. And of course, he had his heyday, having been involved in the war and in basically unpleasant circumstances, traumatizing circumstances. They got together; they were flavor of the month for years, and then time kind of moved on, and he did all those shows on the radio. They tried them on the television with sort of puppets and things, if I remember rightly.
That's right, yeah.
And then he had those other TV programs, which were Cue This and Cue That, and the freedom to do stuff on radio is not quite there in television. So what looked like, and I suppose he was a bit older. So anyway, the time moved on. So Monty Python kind of picked up on a lot of his ideas, which you're entitled to do in what you can broadly say is an art form. So they respected him, but they'd taken on forward, and he was left without a regular gig, and that's painful for. All of us, think things happen and the circus moves on. So I think he was a bit bitter about, he'd be invited onto a chat show or to play some music, but to give him, a studio full of, an audience and a slot and a script to write, and he, there were many fewer opportunities.
Yeah, but, he was talking about when he was talking to you, he was talking about just what you said there. He was complaining because he was such a contradictory character. He would contradict himself from one week to the next, and often he was very effusive in his praise of the Pythons. But this week he was a little bit bitter, and he was saying that they basically copied everything he did in the Q series. And he also said that he'd written to John Cleese recently, asking for a part in, God forbid, the film Fierce Creatures. Do you remember that film?
Oh, I do, yes. Well, he was lucky not to get a part in that because Fierce Creatures wasn't particularly good. But I think he did crop up in, was it Life of Brian? I think he was in the name. They gave him a bit there, which was good of them. So he was in the better film.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, he wasn't... He may have been bitter, he may have been pretending to be bitter, but he didn't, waste his time, because he wrote several volumes of memoirs, published poetry. Puckoon he wrote quite a while before, the time interview. But he still was able to get published and have interest in him. But, everybody gets bitter and twisted by the end.
I just wrote to Cleese, he's doing this big film, and I said, can I have a part in it?
Yeah.
And he wrote back via a secretary, Dear Mr. Milligan, and every part is filled up.
Yeah.
So I wrote and said, no, can there be a part for a foreign legioner who doesn't do anything in the film, but just keep shooting to him in the desert, and he's shooting Arabs? I said, they never answered that.
I've got a less involved memory of Harry Secombe, because I saw Harry Secombe in a show called, it was either called The Three Musketeers or it might have been The Four Musketeers. Maybe you would know. Four Musketeers, musical version. I hope this is not disrespectful to him, but we went along to see it. And just before the show began, there was one of those awful announcements you get in the theatre from time to time. And they said, I'm sorry to say that, because Harry Secombe was very much the star of the show. Sorry to say that Mr. Secombe has got a problem with his voice, a heavy cold. And so the audience, now he will, nonetheless, he will be able to perform tonight. But his voice isn't up to singing. So when he'll perform, but as it comes to the songs, it's pre-recorded. It's his voice, but he won't be singing. So on we went, and he did a bit of acting, then there's a bit of singing, and of course he's a goon, he's a comedian. While the voice is carrying on singing, he doesn't just lip sync, he was mucking around and stopping and starting and making faces. So we got a whole lots of extra jokes. So, this is an interesting night to be here. And then, you know, a few weeks later, I was talking to somebody else, and they said, they'd seen the show. And I said, and I said, the night I went there, his voice wasn't. So, that happened. We must have been there the same night, because that happened the night. And then we worked out we were completely different nights, weeks apart. And then I think we found a third person who'd been another. And what he must have done, he must have sung it on the first night, or maybe the first week, and then thought, this is hard work. Number one, I don't want to have to keep hitting these notes. Number two, I can go for a run, get some extra laughs anyway. So I don't think he ever sang the part from some early part on, which was very clever of him, because at no point, because you know, there won't be reviewers, wouldn't have been coming in and out, and it wasn't the same as nowadays. It would be obvious on Twitter and things that people would be saying, great night with Harry Secombe, though unluckily his voice wasn't working. So that's an anecdote about him, and I hope that's not revealing something awful about Harry Secombe years after.
Oh, no. Well, if I had the choice between watching him singing live or watching him miming and just arsing about, I'd go for the arsing about.
I agree. I was very happy with it, but I was young and naive, and I suppose I was slightly shocked.
Well, at least he turned up. At least they, you know, when they said, unfortunately, Harry Secombe's ill, at least they didn't get his understudy, and it turned out to be Charlie Drake or someone like that.
Well, it could have been Charlie Drake, I suppose. I don't know, can't remember what his singing voice was like. But yes, you do. Yes, he did. Yes, he did do some songs. Yes, it could have been him.
Scrolling right back to your earliest beginnings, Clive.
Yeah.
Because I just looked, I'm not going to mention the date, of course, but I'm looking at when you were born. And it's quite significant in Goon Show history. Okay. So the week you were born.
Right.
Was the week, getting back to Spike and, you know, his challenges. It was the week that Milligan was famously underwent a significant breakdown. He was admitted to hospital for about 9 or 10 weeks.
Okay. Right.
And
is this when he was away, and is it Michael Benteen had to take over from him or somebody else?
It was the third series of the Goon Show. So Benteen had been in the first two and left at the end of series two. Series three begins towards the end of 52. Okay. Milligan basically is feeling the pressure massively, having to write these scripts. And he's gone on record and said that he wanted a legitimate excuse to stop having to write the Goon Show. Okay. And in his fevered mind, he thought, if I kill Peter Sellers, then I won't have to write the Goon Show anymore. Okay. So what he did, because he lived in the same apartment building as Sellers at the time. I think I'm right in saying that. So what he did was he got a potato peeler, and he marched to Sellers' flat, intending, so he said, to kill him. And Sellers at that time, Sellers being Sellers, had a flesh plate glass door.
Mm.
And the story is that Milligan walked right through the glass door, you know, and injured himself. I can't see that happening, but anyway, he walked into the glass door, and it basically saved Peter Sellers' life. Apparently, I don't think Milligan had any real intention of stabbing him, but that's the legend, if you know what I mean.
And
as a result of that, Milligan was admitted to hospital, was sectioned, admitted to, put into hospital, and he was away from the show for about 9 or 10 weeks. And in his absence, Graham Stark and Dick Emery did alternate weeks to cover for his absence.
Well, I think I knew a bit of that story, but those details either I never knew or I've forgotten. But that's an interesting insight into the psychology of Milligan, or indeed anybody, that the mind comes up with the most ludicrous solution. the simple problem, I can't quite meet this deadline. Solution would be get somebody else to write it, or I get a doctor's note to say I can't do it for the rest of this series. Please, BBC, give me a series off, or I resign from showbiz. All those are better than deciding to kill a colleague, which is going to have a consequence down the line, which is bigger than the awkwardness of not being able to complete the series. But your mind can go down odd ways, can't it?
Well, that's it. Now, and the Goons producer for the first two series, I'm trying to think if he was still the producer for the third series. I should know this, but anyway. But the producer was Dennis Mayne Wilson.
All right, yes.
And I know that he figured in your early career, didn't he, quite significantly?
He did. We're skipping forward from my birth time, which you've decorously...
kind of give it away to me.
No, but I'm grateful for that, because I don't suppose I'll ever get round to it. But if I were ever to write my memoirs,
yeah,
it occurs to me, for me and indeed anybody else writing memoirs nowadays, there are a number of things you don't want to actually include in your memoirs anymore. Normally, you just pump in lots of bits of information just to make it nice and clear and snappy. And you might ordinarily just put your date of birth, or the name of your first school. You'll mention your first dog. You'll mention your mother's maiden name. None of these you want to mention anymore.
No.
Because they're all clues to getting access to your bank account and all the other things. So you've got to find, and I'd thought of a way of indicating roughly when I was born, but without actually spelling out the date of birth, because it's close to what was allegedly the last smog in London. I was in a few days one way or the other of that. But now I can say I was born during the time when Spike Milligan had been sectioned or was in that sort of prospect because of attacking a fellow performer. And this clearly infused my soul as well. But not that I've ever wanted to attack anybody. No. But yes, Dennis Mayne Wilson comes much. So we skip forward quite a few years. When I was at Cambridge in the footlights doing reviews and things, the review that we were in 1974, which was quite a jolly review. I wouldn't say it was the best one ever. It wasn't particularly innovative, but Dennis Mayne Wilson saw it and he liked it. He liked us. There were a couple of good performers in it, Griff Rhys-Jones and an actor, as he still is, called Jeff McGiven, who was a brilliant performer.
Oh, great, yeah.
And one or two. I mean, I I caught his eye. I can't remember him singling me out in particular. But anyway, you could almost say he latched onto us for a bit, and he encouraged us to, one way or another, it meant that review was on television, that he produced it, and also in the West End. Neither of which, both of which rather, really exposed it for being not quite good enough in either situation. Not helped by the fact that it was filmed during a cameraman strike, which used to happen in those days. So we were filmed in the West End theatre with sport cameramen. There were sort of action replays of some of the better jokes. Was it off colour? Let's look at that again. And so we, But anyway, he was very entertaining because he was one of the great producers of radio, then television, and worked with Johnny Spate and all the and quite a slight man in terms, not very tall and not very fat. The expression you probably use about him is he liked to drink, which yes. TV producers like to do. I mean, he wasn't rolling drunk, but he of an evening he'd have a few drinks, and he was an enthusiast and loved encouraging people, and he encouraged us, but he also encouraged lots of other people, probably with greater success for his career, those other people than us. But he was entertaining to have such a great man around.
Yeah, and he liked to smoke as well, didn't he?
I think he did, but it wasn't so. Probably, if you saw film of that, you look at TV programs or films from the olden days, even the bits of the olden days that you're in. You just go, gosh, everyone's smoking the whole time.
Yes.
But everybody did. Not something I ever did, but it was just a normal thing of life that, you know, if you spent an hour in a pub, or you went to dinner with some friends in their house, or you went on the upstairs deck of a bus, or even in the underground, you smelled of smoke the whole time. Because if you weren't smoking, 50% of the people around you were.
And it's I don't want to go off on a tangent, but it's amazing because smoking in public places was banned. I think it was 2007. So let's say 15 years ago, just over,
yes.
Whatever. It's amazing. I mean, I used to smoke. I used to go out with friends on a Saturday afternoon and smoke a full packet of 20 fags in the course of an afternoon in a pub. You know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'd come home stinking. Or,
but you're working in an office. If two or three people smoked, they just smoked. Nobody. I mean, it was quite sort of, and I always felt rather sorry for smokers because it's never been a thing to worry me one way or the other, because I've never wanted to smoke, so I'm not feeling tempted. But it never really bothered me that there was a bit of smoke around. It's only after it's been banned you realise, oh, it is actually quite pleasant not to smell of smoke after an evening out.
Absolutely. You started sort of performing at the Comedy Store in its early days.
Yeah.
Now, I think John Lloyd said, did you heckle him at one point?
No, I always liked the I always liked it. I had it. The Comedy Store, especially in its early days, was quite a challenging crowd because the audience didn't really know what stand-up comedy was in a sort of weird way. So it was in a strip club. It was something which was a strip club during the week, and they had this, and then it was alternative comedy, non-sexist, non-racist, all very modern and progressive when it was a comedy place. And they're usually sort of drink rears its ugly head as well. So it's, you know, at midnight, 1 a.m, 2 a.m. performing. But you get a lot of heckling. You got a lot. It wasn't an easy environment. Nobody knew who you were because we were all new people. But I quite liked the atmosphere of heckling. I felt I thrived in it rather than put off by it. So, but the only time I can ever remember it going wrong as far as the audience was concerned was I was heckling John Lloyd. He was in the audience. And I knew him, and he was, you know, the Whiz Kid producer. And I made the mistake of trying to sort of refer to him in the audience and say, well, we've got the producer of Not 9 o'clock News. And I was going on to do some jokes about that program and about him. But what I hadn't reckoned with, Keith Allen, who was one of the top, you know, an actor now and very, very forceful for me. He's well known, but he's one of his things at the time, he was a very impressive comedian, always going off in innovative ways. Well, he was in the audience and he was drunk, which wasn't unusual. And he took against John Lloyd being referred to, and he decided to be disparaging about Not 9 o'clock News. I mean, I don't know why. There's no.
Yeah.
So I was faced with. I can claim, I think legitimately, I've never found it impossible to carry on performing, even at the Comedy Store, even with some hecklers. But I couldn't quite cope with a member of the audience heckling another member of the audience.
it was the most
strange thing. And the person doing the heckling was the best known of all the comedians there. But anyway, it was a difficult night for me. But I can't really blame John Lloyd; it wasn't his fault. I could blame Keith Allen, but Keith Allen did the funniest performance I've ever seen, I think ever, in the Comedy Store on a different night. So I have plus and minus memories of him.
Yes.
In that particular location.
Before we go any further, I'd like now to take this opportunity to do a tiny little slice of the act for all those grovelling, cretinous, moronic comics out there in Noddy Land. That was the sound of me earning 10 quid.
The best thing he did, and it's the funniest thing I've ever seen in comedy, he came on with no clothes on and did a ventriloquist act. And he just stood there, started talking to his puppet, every now and then he would readjust his, as what we call in the law, his person, and he would just carry on, and he explained, this may look like a radical act, but it was just the oldest way of doing ventriloquism known to man, is that the idea of ventriloquism really is that you can't stop your lips moving, but the idea is to stop the audience looking at your lips. And nobody in the audience has looked at my lips since I came on.
Just on John Lloyd, obviously, I know you did a bit of writing for Not the 9 o'clock News, I believe.
I did a little bit, yes. When I was, sorry to refer back to university days, but I did a couple of what we call May Week reviews at Cambridge, which happened in June, and then they get a lot of exposure around different places.
Wasn't that a Clive James memoir? May Week was in June.
Yes, very probably. Yes, I think you're right. Yeah,
sorry.
So when you come to do it, you generally have to have a director to be in charge who isn't there. So I've done this myself after I left. I directed a review, but the time I was sort of nominally in charge, I got John Lloyd to direct not the one I was talking about with Dennis Maymoles, the next year's review. So I like to think that I set his career on its way by employing him as a director. But he was already a producer at Radio 4 and was already coming up with lots of different formats and shows and things. Mm. And as you know, from having interviewed him, or people might know, he's extraordinarily produced in a way because he's got several huge highlights in his producing career, radio and television. And I don't think there are, there may be no sort of downlights. You know, everything he's done has been a sort of great success.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I think he wouldn't have achieved any of that if I hadn't allowed him to really work through some of his ideas directing a review. So when he had Not Like Rock News, he the way he liked to work on that, is to get as many scripts as possible from as many people as possible and have a huge pile, and then he would personally stay up all night worrying himself to a frazzle to reduce it down to a smaller pile, which they would then film and record, and then sometimes bits and pieces of my work might survive, but not a huge amount. But I was being a lawyer at the time, so I only could contribute.
Of course. Yes, of course.
More small amounts, and only small amounts of those small amounts were worth doing anyway.
Well, I know that you were more involved with a show that I consider, I think it's criminally, what's the word, underappreciated today. Smith and Jones, the last Smith and Jones. I love that show, and I know you did a lot of the head to heads, didn't you, and whatnot in that.
Yes, that's what I mainly did. I suspect the people who listen to your podcast know all this already. But
yes.
so Not Nine O'Clock News had four stars in its heyday. Rowan Atkinson, Pamela Stevenson, and Mel Smith, Griff Rhys-Jones, and they got enough together to do their own show, which they eventually were producing with their own company. But along the way, I wrote a sketch, which I thought was a good sketch, because it would give Mel Smith, it was sort of like a parody of the Tony Hancock in the Blood Donor. You know, the blood donor episode.
Yes.
I just thought, well, I'd update it, and Mel would be a sperm donor. So I set this thing in going along to a sperm bank, and obviously the number of jokes almost write themselves when you do that. But they said, oh no, well, they wanted to do it, but it was a format that they already had, which I think they'd done in adverts, and they'd make it a conversation. So take my jokes and make a conversation between Griff and Mel about. And we rewrote it later and made it ruder. It was quite mild, I think, on the first television go through, considering the topic. Yeah. And this was these head-to-heads, which were unusually performed, because you had Griff and Mel just sitting opposite each other. It was a locked-off camera, so there was no director deciding whose reaction shot he would go to or anything like that. The studio audience didn't even see them, you know, in the flesh. They were behind the screen, because it was all focused on them and their faces. And they were both brilliant in their different ways of doing it. So the first few series, I wrote those, or there was a sort of working practice that we had. I would we'd have a conversation about what we might cover with me and Griff, or me, Griff and Mel, and a producer or five. And then I would go away and write it up. And almost universally, Griff would then say, Clive, it's way too long, and you've left out all the best jokes. So he said that virtually every time. So I did all the donkey work on it, but then it got reduced down, and eventually they performed it. And I can never work out how they both were so good, because Griff, I don't know how he could remember which version they were now going to do, because he had at least 20 versions in his head, from my epic work, which would have lasted 25 minutes, down to the you know, my 10-minute version, to his 8-minute version, to the producer's 6-minute, you know, whatever, yeah, whatever it was. Yeah. And Mel had just got the final version, glanced at it, and then could perform it. So you get that nervy performance of Griff, I think comes from, which is the next line, and Mel with that sort of, and just saying it, because he knew roughly where he was going. So it was very much in the performance, but I made my contribution. But as I said, I did the bit of the donkey work behind the scenes.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, the sperm donor dialogue, if I'm right, it's got that line that's stuck with me to this day, where Mel talks about going to the sperm clinic, and Griff says something like, how's that happen? And Mel says, what do you mean? He said, and Griff goes, well, how come?
I think that sounds like the level of yes, you see, once you've set, you see those but once you've set the scene, the jokes are there, aren't they? You don't Absolutely. Have to work too hard at them. You don't have to spell them out. In fact, if you spell them out too much, they wither and die. But I think it was not too bad in terms of taste and decency. But later on, they did stage versions and a naughty record version of That's some right. of their stuff. And I think we added a few more in your face jokes, if that's not a bad way of putting it. But so we had to think of a topic. They were usually to do with something awkward happening in Mel's life and Griff misunderstanding it. So it could, and it wasn't always about sex, but it could have been about incontinence, or it could have been about going to prison, you know, anything. But they're quite fun to do, because and I used to do the warm-ups on that show. So there are a lot of more complicated sketches, which are a nightmare for everybody. But especially the warm-up man, because if you set a sketch in, let's say something simple, like you're having a tea with a vicar, and you know there's Griff and Mel, and there's somebody playing the vicar, and there's a woman who's coming in to confront one of them, and they come in, and somebody knocks the teapot over, so I've got to reset. So we now have got an unspecified amount of time. If it's quick, nothing happens. Oh no, we're a bit longer. So as you can see, the sketch is going well. You have to do this bit of blinking and, you know, try and laugh in the same spot next time. All right, we're resuming. And then we finish that, and there's another sketch. Well, Mel's got to go and put a different wig on for the next thing. How long is that going to take? But with, at least with the head to head, they were roughly, appeared as they were. And they had to get it right. They could only film it once. It never felt it would work if you did it again in front of the same audience. So they had to do it just straight the way through. And the only editing they did was either to cut off the beginning or the end if it was too long. There's no monkeying around with it. I was a better warm up person than I was writer, really. But I was always made sure the audience was primed, hyped to hysteria, ready for the head to head. There was no question. I'm sorry, no, we can't proceed yet. I've got to do another 5 minutes to make sure we were absolutely at fever pitch for that one, because otherwise I've achieved nothing.
Absolutely. And you did warm up for Blackadder as well, didn't you? Did you alternate with Ben or something?
Ben was in it, obviously. Oh, no, really, no, he wasn't in it. I think I do remember one episode where we had a particularly troubling time. Ben sort of joined me, which was very kind of him. Now, what was the problem? In those days, they were quite keen to finish the recording at a, let's say it was 10 o'clock, because if they went beyond that time, all the, you know, everybody got double time or something, you know, overtime, or there's an extra charge. And it was important economically, I think, to the production company. And one particular time when Rowan has a sort of suppressed stutter, which lends comedy to quite a lot. You know that thing about calling, there's a girl pretending to be a boy, he's called Bob. And it's funnier because of that. But I think he got stuck on a word, and it meant that time was going by. So we had to keep stopping and me infilling and Ben infilled. And to give him his due, the thing about Rowan is that I think anybody else would have said, we'll find another word so that he's not going to stammer or stutter on it.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't, because that was the word. I can't remember what the word was now, but that was the funniest word. And there was no question of him doing a slightly less funny word in order to get over that hill. Though, oddly enough, probably he'd have got a huge laugh by putting any other word in, because the students there would be a sort of tension releaser. But you're quite right. Probably Ben did some weeks and I didn't do it. I don't know. But I did some early series of that. And then my own TV career took off, and I probably thought of myself as too haughty to do other people's warm up. But I didn't do that. I don't think I did the last series, which is, you know, the one set in the First World War, which is a shame, really, because it's one of the great shows of all time, really, that series of all time, the Blackadder Goes Forth.
Well, you were busy doing Whose Line Is It Anyway by that
I
point.
Probably was, I was doing my own career by then. But behalf, it's a warm-up man is literally unheralded position, because all those people who get credited at the ends of the forgotten art of sketch shows and sitcoms on the telly, almost never did anyone give a credit to the warm-up person. It was slightly embarrassed to admit that there was somebody who's actually jollying the thing on. I don't know why, but just in the same way that some sort of panel-y kind of games, they don't really like to admit that somebody's actually worked on the programme and written some jokes. So they don't like to say writer or script written by. They say programme associate.
Or consultant.
Consultant. Nobody knows what's that? Who's an associate of the programme? Is he somebody who's done the financial deal, or is she somebody who has come in to sort out the logistics? What could an associate? It's the writer. So those bits when somebody speaks. So some of them are more honest these days, but it's a sort of that's a euphemism. But with the warm-up people, they even bother to. They don't say program facilitator or something or. Audience wrangler. No.
Audience wrangler.
Uncredited.
Felix Bowness was one of the exponents of that, wasn't he? From Heidi.
Yeah,
and
there's
I.
some yeah, mm. there it's a noble art. I mean, you could do it in a variety of different ways. As I said, I used to do it for shows I'd written jokes for. And then I became in demand as a warm-up person. Let's say more than I was in demand for writing and other people's shows.
Chekhov.
And there's a Chekhov.
Right. At least you work, though.
Come on.
What's work. That? I get up in the morning, I have two glasses of vodka. No more than that. Two glasses of vodka, I go off down the hill. At the end of that hill, I see her. You don't have to worry about that. You're handsome and charming. You don't have TB.
What happened?
I don't know.
It was your mic.
What happened?
I don't know, there was a lot of pain inside for a moment. I went up to her bedroom and she was there, actually waiting for me. If I knew that Anya Tereskova could wait for more than 5 minutes, I'd feel like an old grub box that's been bounced off a zebra's head somewhere in Siberia.
If I'd known this part was going to be so small, I'd never have taken it.
You've clearly not worked with John before.
Just on Whose Line Is It Anyway, and I appreciate we're barreling through topics here, but you know, you
yeah, no,
you,
that's fine. It's time. It's good that you're taking it out of. Well, we are. It's probably my fault taking it out of a chronological order, so it'll confuse the listeners to this.
Yeah,
as well, much as it will.
That's
yeah.
the way this podcast rolls.
Yeah.
No, I love certainly the earlier series on. I've listened to the radio series, but the TV series, what I would call the, I don't know how many, the first three or four series I absolutely adored, had taped as many as possible. And right. With what I consider the classic sort of lineup, you've got Merton, Josie Lawrence, John Sessions, Tony Slattery, and others, of course. But
yeah,
I know Peter Cook and Stephen Fry were there occasionally, weren't they? And I'm genuinely not saying this. I'm not trying to make you blush sweetly here, Clive, but I felt your contribution to that show was kind of, again, it was underappreciated maybe or overlooked a little bit.
Well, I don't know. I suppose we did it on the radio first, and it seemed to work for me personally. It worked well on the radio because there was plenty of opportunity for me to interact with the audience. Everything feels more relaxed in a radio studio, and we didn't know yet what we were doing anyway. So I did quite a lot of chit chat with the audience. When we went onto television, I felt we were always under pressure of time, and I thought I would go completely unnoticed, and that I'd be so just be almost like a continuity announcer. But I forget, I can't really explain who explained this to me because it's somebody whose reputation has gone now. But so the main thing, if you're there every week, you will get noticed anyway, you know, whatever you do. You become part of the furniture, but you're part of the setup. So I that's interesting you like those first series because in a way it was sort of settling down. When we did the radio series, Dan Patterson, who invented it, he managed to recruit John Sessions, who's a great improviser, who'd done lots of different things on stage. And I'd seen him perform, and you think, well, I've written for him in other things as well. But how could he, use his talents? And here was a show that Dan had come up with, improvisation. Well, fine, that's good. Stephen Fry, so he was going to be a captain of a two-man team every week. And Stephen Fry was going to be the other captain. And of course, Stephen Fry can sort of do anything, certainly just to give it a whirl. And that's what he did. It turned out he didn't really like doing it, but he seemed to do it well. And I, as in a lot of things, was completely wrong in my analysis because I thought, oh, this is going to be very tricky for John and Stephen because they'll give us their best shots on things. But then new people be coming in every week. The new people would all be find it much easier. Because they'd be bringing their new stuff and they'll be really struggling. Well, I'm completely wrong. The more you do it, the more adept you get at it. And so that applied on the radio and the television. When we moved to television, Stephen just sort of revealed he found it all a bit too much of a strain and he would only do a few. And then John was sort of, well, if Stephen's not going to do it, I don't think I want to do it, which was tough on Dan because he'd thrown in his job at the BBC radio in order to start doing television just for that series. That was the only thing he had to do until then. His two stars were sort of deciding or not, maybe not doing it. But anyway, he persuaded John. So for the first few series, John, who was a very individualistic way of improvising and brilliant at it, but the show kind of moved on, and he I think he'd had enough as well. So the lineups changed. But you're mentioning all those different people on it. There were sort of all sorts of people who tried to do it, and it turned out, we felt anyway, that after a while that there are people who are very good at improvising, and it's no point in trying to force the issue and getting a star guest in or somebody else to jolly it along. It was better to stick to the people who are good at improvising. So that's how it settled down a bit in later series to have. I think Dan took it a bit far because I would have varied the lineups a bit more, but what do I know? I wasn't producing it. So.
Do you see Tony Slattery at all these days?
Or? I have seen him. Not somebody else was asking me just recently about this. So we've done Whose Line Is It Anyway on the stage in a variety of forms. Some less formally than others. So we've done it in Edinburgh two or three times, obviously at the festival. And then Dan has produced it The Albert Hall, we've done it, a couple of other London theatres, and the Palladium Theatre. So now, in the ones in Edinburgh, though, I think he did 2 years. Anyway, the guy producing it there said, I've persuaded Tony Slattery to do it. And it was great to see him again. And the audience loved him. You know, they're really, because they were the, you know, big theatre in the Edinburgh Festival. And we've got younger people joining the cast, but certainly having, you know, Greg Proops or Colin Mochrie, Josie Lawrence, you know, have people that people, and Tony Slattery, they really loved him coming out. And he was charming to work with. But, you know, he's had his ups and downs in life. So he was adored for his comedy and his rudeness on the telly. But also for his, you know, he was kind of sexy, you know, for men and women all fell in love with him. And they're still in love with him he comes on stage now. But he even split his trousers on stage in the theatre. And he'd done that on television, you know, 20 years before. So what it is with him and trousers, I don't know.
Well, he showed his backside on television in that sitcom. What was it called? Was that Jimmy Mulville sitcom?
But this is just not wearing very, very many clothes, and what I was wearing split. So when he did it on stage, he said, "Oh, Clive, I've done it again," as though this happened every night, or this has happened this afternoon with us or something. But this is a reference to, you know, 20, 30 years before. It just happened to be on his mind.
I love him. I love all of them, you know, Merton. Yeah. Sandy Toksvig as well. She was great.
As I say, the people who can do it, do it. And so there was a time when, well, of course, as I'm no doubt you know, and your listeners know, the British people who do improvisation, of which there are quite a lot, but there's a little a band of them, the Comedy Store Players, were doing it every, you know, once a week in those days in the Comedy Store, and they largely still are. I mean, some of the people have changed around a bit, but Josie Lawrence, she must have done thousands of performances, thousands of, and the only difficulty with her when doing in the Whose Line format, where I have to sort of be, you know, to give me something to do, I have to sort of take the suggestion and hand it on. The only difficulty with her is she'll say, no, I don't want to do that. I did that last week, or that's on YouTube. I don't want to do that again. You've got to get something different, because, so I don't know how she manages to find audiences who can come up with enough different things to suggest that she does, because she doesn't want just to trot out a song that she's got in her head from having improvised it 15 years ago, which a lot of people will be happy to do. She wants to do a new thing.
Yeah.
So that, bear that in mind. If you're ever in the audience with Josie, don't shout out anything she's ever done before, which, since that covers almost everything, you have to be something that's just been invented this week and see if she can cope with it.
Okay. I just want to cycle back briefly. You said about writers on panel shows and things like that that get called consultants or whatever. And of course, there's a point to this, Clive. Just thinking, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. For years and years and years, had a program consultant called Ian Paterson, who basically who wrote all the rather off-color lines for Humph to deliver.
Yes, okay.
And of course, two of the major performers in Clue were Graham Garden, of course, and Jeremy Hardy.
Yeah.
And a show that you were involved with, which I loved, and it was, I think it only had two series, If I Ruled the World, which had Jeremy and Graham as opposing team captains. And it was like a political comedy panel show, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an interesting structure. I think it may have been Richard Osman's idea. He certainly, working for Hattrick at the time, working on that show. Mm. You know, Richard Osman, who's a great, does everything now, but he was young, and he was only 6'8", 9" tall at the time, so quite young and small. But anyway, it was a slightly complicated idea to get, but once you've got it, so it was a fictional world in which Graham and Jeremy were politicians, and again, we'd have two different people to come on every week, and and we would then do it like Question Time, but they had to act like politicians, and it was a bit sad because Jeremy it suited him really well because he didn't always work that well on television. He's brilliant on radio and stage and everything. But I'd say this to him when he was alive. It was, he had a sort of slightly odd way of looking slightly off camera when he was on television, which didn't always work in other shows, but this worked perfectly for this because he just looked like a very shifty politician, sort of looking around, thinking of something to say, and he was very funny doing that. Graham Garden was very funny, obviously slightly older, but again had that sort of the gravitas of somebody who speaks in a conventional establishment-y kind of voice. And then different people came on; some got the idea better than others. I'm just trying to think of his name. Who's the guy who was a political guy? He's called John. He was on Strictly Come Dancing and
Sergeant.
Almost won. John Sargent. He was, sorry, forget his name, but John Sargent was brilliant when he came on because he'd had years of interviewing politicians, so he knew exactly their cadences. Anyway, it worked. You know, when you do a show like that, you never know if it's going to work or not. So you do a series, and then you get a second series. That is the only endorsement that really means anything. It means, oh, right, it was good enough. I can't remember now why it then stopped after two series. I don't remember being aggrieved that it was roaring away so well, or I certainly don't remember it failing or the audience figures failing away. I think there was probably something either very simple that it wasn't good enough or very complicated and it didn't fit in with, you never know, somebody who commissions a program then leaves the broadcaster and you lose your champion. But I think it was, I enjoyed doing it. It was a slightly different thing for me to do. And it was great working with Jeremy as well, but, you know, Graham Garden was, having, if we've started this conversation, I'm sorry I read that again. He was one of the stars of that, one of the writers of that.
Yeah.
And he's a really great guy. He can be quite quiet on panel games and things that he's on, but every now and then, whatever he says, it's always brilliant. So you are raking up an unhappy memory which wasn't in my mind, but you think, oh, yeah, that's a shame that we didn't do. I think you could have done a few more series. But maybe it was just it required a little bit too much imagination on behalf of the audience. So it would have a niche audience who would get it. But people stumbling on it might think, what, as people tend to these days, you sort of scroll around a bit, don't you? They might have thought, oh, I don't know, what's this about? Is that like Graham Garden? I don't know.
Two opposing team captains saying, I couldn't disagree more. Which is what they seem to say every. That was one of the rounds.
That was one of the rounds, wasn't it? And then we took questions from the audience, which were quite, you know, that was quite fun, you know. And Graham was always keen to develop a sort of running gag that could go from one week to another or throughout the program. And it was a good way for Jeremy to be sort of the light-hearted comedian in him, also combined with he has that, you know, disdain for lots of politicians as well. So it worked well for him. There it is. These things come and go.
Well, we now come to a round called I Couldn't Disagree More. This tests out the politician's ability to disagree with the policies of his opponents, however reasonable they may sound. This is for you, Graham. So if Jeremy and Richard could come up with some policies, see if Graham could disagree with them.
We think it's important for young people to practice safe sex.
No, I couldn't disagree more. Don't waste condoms practicing. Save them for the real thing.
Jeffrey Archer is notoriously litigious and a very, very nice guy.
Well, you're half right.
Bernard Manning is a racist.
Bernard who?
Were you annoyed or nonplussed or just surprised by the Brass Eye sketch in which it claimed that you'd shot dead Noel Edmonds?
No. I didn't shoot dead him. He killed me.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
I thought it was the other way around.
No. The plot of it is I, for some reason, having dinner at Noel Edmonds's house, I think in the country somewhere, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And at some point he kills me, and then so they interrupt the whatever their pretend program is going on, which they interrupt with a news flash that I have been attacked, and then they cut away to I think I can't remember how much of this you see, but he's on the roof with my head in his hand. He's jacked my head off, and the Yeah, well, I wrote not in complaint, but acknowledged it happened. And I said, "Well, I think the only thing that I could, as a lawyer, that I could see might be libelous to me, in it, the suggestion that I was having dinner with Noel Edmonds, which is a bit harsh on Noel Edmonds, because I suppose it's not impossible. And also, what was disappointing to me was that it caused no furore whatsoever. I mean, nobody. It wasn't even the most shocking thing on that episode of that programme. And as for, you know, people were a bit worried. Some of the people involved were sort of slightly apologetic that, you know, I might have, you know, members of my family might have been, or friends might have been upset by this. But not one. I mean, nobody. I had no elderly relative ever, you know, contacting me. Say, "Are you all right? I saw that." Nobody either. It was sufficiently obviously funny and a comedy. Or
nobody cares.
Nobody cares about me.
I can't believe I got it round the wrong way. For some reason, I had it in my head. Yeah. It was the other way. Anyway.
Well, look, normally at this point, I'd say, well, it's probably me because I don't find my own memory very reliable. I'm very confident on this, though.
Absolutely.
But do come back to me and kick me off if I'm wrong. But,
absolutely.
The world of show business has tonight reacted with sadness and horror.
Well, I just heard a rumour about it. I don't know what's happened at all.
Apparently Clive Anderson was shot.
Clive Anderson was shot by who? Not
by Noel Edmonds, yeah.
What? No.
I'd say there's no excuse. None whatsoever.
And if Edmonds is still inside the house?
Well, just shoot him. I mean, people like me, we're supposed to be rascals. But it's your Edmonds, your Thomas Hamiltons, your Hungerford guy, all so-called nice people.
They ought to shoot him off the roof as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And there'll be an update at 11:30 after our next scheduled programme.
It seemed to me the obvious casting or replacement for Angus Deighton on Have I Got News For You would have been you as permanent host.
Yes. Well, I did do it once. I was the host once, which I thought I did pretty well, I thought. But I didn't. I've been back on as a guest.
Which Boris hosted.
Yes.
Yeah.
The sequence of... of how when I did it though, so that was early on. He did the one I always say to Angus, he is directly responsible for Boris becoming prime minister, because the boost to his career came from when he was hosting it, and he was quite he was very Boris like when he was doing it, because he was you know, reading out the auto cue, which for those links, which is all, you know, so, and he was stumbling on it and saying, "Well, what's this about?" And I asked the producers, "Well, is he come in late? Has he not?" No, he's been here all day. He's had all the preparation that everyone else has had. That's his way of doing things. He was a way of distancing himself from the jokes and having his own joke. It was to pretend he was just reading for the first time.
Yeah.
But that obviously appealed to the public. They thought they wanted a prime minister like that, who was stumbling and bumbling his way through things, which is entertaining, but not necessarily what you need in a crisis. But I was happy to, you know, present it on one or two occasions, but whether I would be the right person to replace Angus, I don't know, because you're always trying to move things along a bit, and I am a year or two older than Angus, so it would be a bit of a retrograde step, and I am, you know, another Oxbridge voice from that era, that type of comedy. They probably, if they were ever going to have a permanent host, they probably might. I don't mean they've got to have a, you know, a change of gender or sexuality or whatever, but you might want somebody not quite so similar to Angus. So maybe you could get somebody 20 years younger or from a different part of the country.
Or Charlie Drake.
Maybe. Well, what they've also discovered, I hope I'm not being unfair to them. They discovered that if they have a role, you know, different host every week, they can probably get away with paying them slightly less than somebody who's been on there every week. So it's probably an economy measure. And but I liked it when I thought it was a good structure when they had a host in command.
Yes.
And two sort of. Well, certainly Paul Merton is the sort of, not naughty schoolboy exactly, but sort of bridling against the rules and the structure. And then, you know, Ian obviously brings his own level of knowledge, you know, intelligence and information to it. And then you can make fun of or play around with the guests. But of course, sometimes, some weeks, I'm not an expert anymore on the programme, but, you know, some weeks the host is kind of the butt of the joke, and other weeks they're just quite good. They're good, but they still haven't got the same command over the show that the permanent host has, and not quite as... It's not quite part of the fabric. But anyway, as I say, I've got my own views about how shows ought to work, but I'm not really responsible. I'm not the producer. I'm not in charge. So any show which is successful, you have to assume the people who are doing it know what they're doing.
Absolutely. And obviously, at the moment, you're still hosting Loose Ends, I believe, on the radio.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That must be pleasurable because it's different every week.
Different every week. It's at the moment, it's very different every week because part of BBC policy, a very firm part of BBC policy at the moment, certainly on Radio 4, is they don't really like so many things coming from London anymore. So there's a very concerted effort to take things out of London. So for the past at least 6 months, maybe longer, we've been doing a lot of programmes not in London. So we've been all around. I've just recorded one in Bristol, but we've done, you know, Manchester or Salford, as they prefer to call it, Leeds, we do Hull, all over the place, which makes us for a slightly different show because we have an audience when we go to places like that to establish its locality. And in due course, the production of the programme is going out of London altogether. So it's an interesting move for an entertainment chat show who'd been located in London, one of the world's capitals of entertainment. But anyway, this is BBC policy. Mm. So there are changes afoot as we go ahead from here.
Okay. Well, as we look to wrap up, I just wanted to just finish off with a... how can I bring this in? Okay. It used to be a running joke on this podcast that there's a handful of goon related topics or projects which were strictly consigned to the pile marked "do not touch." You know, so
okay,
stuff which for various reasons was of questionable taste or quality or both. You know what I mean?
Is this a program involving Spike and Milligan?
There you go. I mean, Spike had this ill-conceived mid-70s. What would you call it? Interracial sitcom called The Melting Pot. So we're never going to cover that, okay?
Yeah.
Harry Secombe's Calypso album. We're never going to cover that, all right?
Yeah.
And there's a pretty dreadful 1970 BBC Two Boxing Day special called Cucumber Castle, which was a medieval comedy in which Spike and Frankie Howard, actually, because you wrote for Frankie Howard, didn't you? They both appeared in this program called Cucumber Castle. Do you remember Cucumber Castle from Boxing Day 1970, Clive, by any chance?
I don't, actually. I'm writing it down, though. I feel, since I've interviewed Spike Milligan and indeed Frankie Howard and worked with him, along with Griffin and others, I'm ashamed. Maybe research was harder in those days, because nowadays you can look up anything. And Cucumber Castle. It was set in a castle made out of cucumbers.
The plot was pretty non-existent. It was a program designed as a showcase for a group, actually, promoting the latest LP, and it was built around them.
Like the Monkees, but
yeah, basically, yeah. It was crowbarring in like ever more ludicrous opportunities for them to burst into song. You know, the thing with sketches in between, and Spike and Frankie Howard were in it. But the problem was that the two principal members of the group couldn't act for Toffee and clearly seemed to lack any interest in the whole production.
Mm.
Okay. And as I said, without that group, Cucumber Castle could have been a pretty good 50-minute BBC Two comedy. Okay.
Yeah.
So my question to you, Clive, is, why do the Bee Gees always have to spoil things?
It was the Bee Gees.
It was a very clunky way of getting to the topic of the Bee Gees. Yeah. The Bee Gees ruined Cucumber Castle. And of course, I was going to avoid talking about the Bee Gees because you get asked it all the time, and I don't want you to waste your breath again talking about it. But you've gone on record and said that you regret it a little bit, don't you? Is that still the case? Or?
Well, it's one of those questions that you... Yeah, in ordinary life, you talk about things quite happily. When there's a journalist with a notepad or a tape recorder these days, and they say, Do you regret the interview with the Bee Gees? You're faced with a choice. You either, and I could go either way on it. Really, said, no, I don't regret it. It's provided me with endless chance of telling people about it, and it's made it memorable. Or you say, oh yeah, well, I regret it. You know, upsetting them, and you know, both are true. Really, I wasn't the awful thing. Anyone is not aware of it. The Bee Gees walked out of the interview, which is you know, not really the thing you're aiming for in an entertaining chat show. But at the time, I used to try and make things absolutely as funny as possible. And the material you're using is the person you're interviewing. And I thought they were up for a bit of a laugh. And I wasn't really trying to be harsh to them. I was just trying to get a lot of rapid-fire laughs and jokes. But I misjudged it on a variety of different levels, and they judged it as, or at least Barry judged it as, something up with which he would not put, and he got up and left, taking the other two with him. Yeah. So it was quite dramatic and distressing at the time. At the time, I felt it was possibly they hadn't got much of a sense of humour, and I think that was what at least half the people, you know, watching it or thinking about it, felt. Possibly as time has gone by, the percentages have gone against me, and I think now it sort of looks worse from the perspective of time, and it comes across as just a uppity, rude host winding up three of the most talented music makers the world has ever produced. But there was a number of points that I wasn't really realizing how I was stamping on sensibilities and. But anyway, it was an odd experience. I'm not offering as an excuse, but what was odd about it is that I'd already recorded a whole program, and they were a pre-record for the next week. So the audience was in a very up state. So was I. They had come. I hadn't spoken to them beforehand, but I understood they were fans of shows of mine. So I thought, so I was probably going up, you know, quicker and fuller speed than I would have done, expecting it to be fantastic. And how wrong I was.
Oh, never meet your heroes, Bee Gees. I remember watching it on transmission. Is that the
yes?
Watching
yeah.
It? Yeah. And just being open mouthed. Because you just didn't see stuff like that on TV, did you?
No, really? Well, did you see it not knowing that it was going to happen?
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Know.
Oh,
no.
Oh, well, that's good, because it's so difficult to get. If I can just elide the conversation slightly, and we don't have time to overburden this podcast with it, but I did a happier thing when I did a thing with Peter Cook where four different characters, and I'm very pleased with that, because it was my suggestion that he did it, and I got it organised and we did it, but the other thing about it is that I don't put it out pre-publicity. Oh, this week there's a special edition. Oh, do you know all the characters can be played by Peter Cook? No, let people see.
Yeah.
Oh, this judge is a bit weird. He looks a bit like Peter Cook. And we should write to be laughing. Oh, and then the next person who comes, well, I don't know, Football Manager, whoever the next one was. Oh, he also, of course, it's Peter Cook. It's Peter Cook all the way through.
And what do you do for a living?
I'm a quality controller in a leading biscuit factory.
All right.
It is my job to test biscuits for comestibility.
Yes.
And I do this by biting into them.
Yes.
Tasting them for flavour and texture.
Fair enough.
And if the biscuit is satisfactory, I allow another 4 million to go by.
Right.
And it's, I haven't tested this
no,
one.
No, no, I'll take that one on trust. Now this is, where do you do this biscuit testing? Where do you live?
Ipswich area, environs of Ipswich.
Environs of Ipswich, right.
The biscuits, yes.
Oh, well, it's a popular area, apparently.
It's very quiet. It nestles in a little valley where we live. We're surrounded by countryside, and we have a small garage.
Yes, well,
I didn't want to, so, and the same with the Bee Gees. It was already a story in the papers before it had happened. So it meant that some people would come in and say, oh, yeah, what's going to happen there? But I think we'd be more objective sort of looking at the programme if you think, oh, this is going all right. It's a bit of a laugh here. But, oh, no, they're going. Well, hang on, what happened there? That I felt was what it was like. But, of course, now people watch and say, oh, I'm going to watch that programme. I love the Bee Gees. You rattle through about 20 tunes. And, who's that bloke? Oh, I never liked him. And, look at him. He's awful. So I don't think I get quite such a fair hearing anymore. And I think also the flavour of how people are interviewed on television has probably softened. I think we're at the harsh era when I was doing it. Now it's all softened down again. So,
Did the president of the global Bee Gees fan club issue a fatwa against you?
Not that I'm aware of, but you never know. I think the good thing is the Bee Gees fans are in the main, I think, rather lovely people.
Dying
so
off.
Well, the Bee Gees, I mean, it's a sad story, actually, the family of them, because for, you know, different reasons, I think their mother was alive when their, you know, they had a younger brother who died. I can only imagine her whole life experience is so extraordinary. You know, one thing or another, they go to Australia from in this country, and the three of them turn into these super singers, but also songwriters. You know, those are two kind of separate skills, which they both are. I'm obviously going over the top in my praise for the Bee Gees now. It's just sort of get me into Bee Gee heaven in due course. It's when you're interviewing somebody with any luck, you are interviewing people who are big stars, who are talented people, and that's if you're going to annoy anybody, it's a talented person you're going to annoy. But I don't think I've annoyed many people quite to the extent that I annoyed them, and nobody's ever walked off. Again, you know, yet, if you know what I mean. So there's always time on loose ends for somebody to dash away.
Well, the last thing I would say is that Robin at least had the good sense not to appear in Cucumber Castle.
Okay. Robin's voice was the most interesting one of all of them. Extraordinary voice. I'm going to look out Cucumber Castle then. So I'll be something to be able to mention if I am waylaid by Bee Gees fans somewhere.
It stinks. They stink. Clive, listen, I've taken up so much of your time. Thank you so much. And
I'm sorry if I probably led you on more of a ramble than most interviews tend to be, but I think we've flown off in different directions.
If you listen to random episodes of this, I love to take things off on tangents and rambling.
Oh, good.
I'm like that myself. So I just mentioned at the top of the show that you have a podcast as well, which is My Seven Wonders.
Yes, I get a guest on to talk about they have to identify the seven wonders of their world. So sometimes I do that like this, you know, down the line, sometimes in a little studio, but quite often now in, with a live audience, which lends a different
It's very good.
Flavor to it.
Have you got another series coming up? Because I think last year was the last batch.
We did some in Edinburgh last year, which is quite an efficient way of doing it. And I've got a few dates coming up arranged, you know, throughout the spring and summer, in places around the country. So we're try it like that. We've done some in the centre of London, but we're doing, you know, these various theatre dates. So there's no point in me trying to just plug the dates now in the course of this conversation. But if anybody wants to see them, they can see them live if it happens to be near them, or we go out online eventually in the usual way.
Very good. Well, Clive, listen, thank you so much, as I say. All the best with the podcast, all the best with Loose Ends and every other project that you're engaged with. And
thank you very much. Always have plenty of projects on the go to keep, dashing around.
Woodland Trust, of course, because you're involved with that quite heavily.
Yes, I'm president of the Woodland Trust. So you don't have to come and see me perform. You can just plant a tree in my honour, and then the planet may be saved in addition to anything else. Yeah.
My friend, my cucumber and I welcome you to Cucumber Castle.
Do you mind speaking louder, Dale?